Hello and welcome to another news episode of BFRR, our Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock and Roll podcast. It's 1st of May, which means we have a holiday in Germany and the, let's say, better part of Switzerland. So I'm very happy that Michael is around today, my co-host Michael. Hi, Michael.
Hi, both.
And we are looking back today to the hottest news in April, so to say. And Michael already said hi, both, which means we have another guest today. We are going to talk a lot about stablecoins. Today, Circle has announced an IPO. For the first time, they have shared insights on their financials, and we will analyze those numbers and see what we can learn from those numbers for the stablecoin industry. And to those end, we have the perfect guest, Simon Salter, CFO and CPO of AllUnity. Simon, it's great to have you on. Maybe you can quickly introduce yourself and, of course, also AllUnity.
Yeah, sure. So I'll try to keep it short. Hi there. My name is Simon. As Alex told, I'm working right now as CFO and CPO of AllUnity. AllUnity is the leading initiative for Euro stablecoins. And our goal is to provide this as a key of, I would say, European infrastructure for on-chain transactions forward. So what is the Euro stablecoin? Maybe still quickly, shortly, for people that have maybe heard this at the first time. A stablecoin is basically a regular currency on a blockchain. And a Euro stablecoin is a euro on a blockchain. So it's just a regular euro, but not within a bank account or within PayPal, but instead on a public blockchain. And this is what we are building right now. We are trying to launch this rather soon than later, as soon as we get the license from BaFin. And before, I was working for mainly banks and financial institutions. I used to be with Commerce Bank, building some capital market stuff there. Used to be head of digital assets at Deutsche Börse Group. For example, kicking off the D7 initiatives for people that are more into that kind of stuff, if you are interested for any weird reasons in security transactions. And after that, I was at Paukauper Salampe in the same role, building also several regulated and licensed crypto businesses. Yeah, that's it.
Perfect. Yeah, I mean, great that you're on, Simon. Maybe just as a disclaimer for everyone, I'm also involved in AllUnity. I'm currently the chairman of the board. But as always, and as you know, everything I do and say here in this podcast is in my personal capacity. So I'm not representing anyone today. I just wanted to make that transparent. All right, let's jump in. Before we go into the stablecoin discussion, as always in our news episodes, a quick view on the market, Bitcoin and ETH prices, ETFs. Michael, maybe you can give us a quick update.
Yes, as we wrap up April, Bitcoin has demonstrated resilience in the face of significant market turbulence this month, currently trading at 95K. Bitcoin has recovered from its mid-month drop that saw prices fall below 85,000. What's particularly striking is Bitcoin's performance against traditional markets. I think while we witnessed the S&P 500 experience its worst week since 2020 and both the Dow and Nasdaq taking substantial hits, Bitcoin has maintained relative stability. This divergence from traditional market movements, to me at least, suggests Bitcoin's maturation as an increasingly uncorrelated asset class. The most noteworthy price action to me occurred following Paul Atkins swearing in as SEC chairman, his pledge to establish a quote-unquote rational, coherent, and principled approach to digital assets regulation triggered a 6% surge in a single day. And that pushed Bitcoin from around 88K to over 94K. This represents Bitcoin's strongest showing in 51 days. Yeah, and then we also have the Bitcoin spot ETFs. April has been a banner month for Bitcoin ETFs, with inflows reaching the highest level since January's all-time high. On April 22nd alone, we saw a staggering 13 million flow into Bitcoin ETFs. This was the largest single-day inflow since Bitcoin reached its previous high above 108,000. Yeah, looking at the breakdown, maybe ARK21 shares Bitcoin ETF led its second largest daily inflows since launch with 270 million approximately. Then Fidelity's Wise Origin Bitcoin Fund followed with about 250 million. And BlackRock's iShares Bitcoin Trust secured 194 million on the third place. The cumulative spot Bitcoin ETF volume show a steady upward trend throughout April, starting around 840 billion and approximating the 900 billion mark at the end of April yesterday. This consistent institutional interest demonstrates that the demand structure for Bitcoin keeps changing. I think we're no longer seeing primarily retail-driven speculation, but rather long-term capital allocation from, for example, macro hedge funds, retirement accounts, and corporate treasuries.
I mean, that was also, I had two observations. One, and I saw that, I'm not sure who posted it, the search intensity of Bitcoin is very, very low. I mean, when you look over the last years, it seems like no one is searching for Bitcoin on Google, which is always a bit of an approximation of retail interest. While at the same time, the price and inflows, as Michael, you just summarized, are relatively high, which could be an indication for its more, let's say, institutional-led demand. So I think that's noteworthy, number one. And number two is, of course, the Bitcoin dominance has increased even further. So I think we are above 61% now. So relative performance of Bitcoin has also been very strong compared to the rest of the market over the last weeks and months.
Yeah, and why that is, we understand when we look at Ethereum and in particular the ETH spot price developments in April, because there we see a different picture explaining why Bitcoin is increasingly dominant. Ethereum has had a more challenging month, currently trading at $1,800. Unlike Bitcoin's recovery, Ethereum has shown greater volatility and less resilience, particularly during the mid-month market turbulence. Ethereum underwent a significant drop around April 7th, falling from about 1,900 to nearly 1,400, so a drop of $500, before beginning a gradual recovery. And yeah, this price action reflects the continuing challenge Ethereum faces in establishing itself as a store of value during market uncertainty, or at least in finding a compatible sticking narrative. Ethereum's underperformance relative to Bitcoin, and that's the price dominance you alluded to, Alex, has been a consistent theme throughout April, with the ETH to Bitcoin ratio continuing to decline. And this divergence, to me, suggests, again, institutional investors are currently prioritizing the simplicity and established narrative of Bitcoin over Ethereum's more complex or less memorable value proposition.
Maybe so.
Maybe as perspective to add, I think, as you mentioned, the value proposition. I mean, the case of Bitcoin as an actual store of value or an investment opportunity, I think it's not even easier, but it's something that works. Because if you look at the development, like within the last couple of years since the bear market after FTX crash, I mean, Ethereum is almost at the same spot. Yeah, maybe a 20-30% premium. Bitcoin has almost developed with a factor of cross 5. Yeah, so clearly using Bitcoin to have an investment that is positively developing, generating alpha, is working, and so people are buying it. But the application of Ethereum, of course, was not store of value. That's not what it's used for. It should be used as the resource for transaction, and this doesn't work because large institutions yet are not using blockchain technology as any kind of actual transaction layer, which is the value proposition of Ethereum. And additionally, it's being questioned whether Ethereum will be the answer, because you have in the same time a development of Solana, which is from a community point of view much stronger than what Ethereum has done. So I think the value proposition has not shown to be realistic yet, to be honest. And question is whether they, as the first runner in this market for transaction platforms, will actually be the winner, even though it might be a winner-takes-it-all market. But they are not the winner yet. They haven't proven the value position yet.
Yeah, very good points. And we had this discussion like over the last months here in this podcast, more than once, like how is Ethereum making progress? How are they performing versus others? I have been very skeptical when the price was, I know it was a couple of months ago, close to $4,000, I believe. Since then, I must say, I mean, now at this current price, there has been a huge correction already. And I mean, I have to mention it again, and we have this disclaimer in the end as well. Nothing we say here is investment advice, but I feel like Ethereum is now way more fairly priced than a couple of months ago. And the good thing here in the podcast is this keeps us honest here, because everything we say will be public, right? So I'm gonna say this now also publicly. I have become more positive again towards Ethereum. I mean, it's almost a 50% drop, or probably a 50% drop now in a couple of months. And over the medium to long run, I mean, with Ethereum, it's very much depending on the performance of the Ethereum Foundation, right? It almost doesn't matter what any Bitcoin Foundation does. Here, you need to trust the Ethereum Foundation doing a good job. But like conceptually, I think the long-term plans of Ethereum are more convincing to me than the plans of any other, let's say, crypto that tries to solve similar use cases. Like scaling via layer twos, in my opinion, is way more efficient than trying to do everything on layer one, for instance, just as a comparison to Solana. So it's definitely way more risky to invest into Ethereum than into Bitcoin, because it's way earlier and less clear whether it will be, let's say, passed by a competitor. But I have become, and I just wanted to mention this here, way more positive again compared to my rant a couple of months ago.
Good. And with that, let's proceed to the Ethereum ETFs. They have shown promising, I would say, but more modest flows compared to their Bitcoin counterparts. Its cumulative ETF volumes show steady growth from about 64 to 72 billion at the end of April. Daily ETF volumes for Ethereum have been more volatile, with a notable spike around April 9th that saw volumes exceed 70-50 million. This coincided with significant price volatility in the broader market. In my opinion, despite these positive flows, Ethereum ETFs haven't demonstrated the same consistent institutional appetite we've seen with Bitcoin. Coming back to our Bitcoin to Ethereum comparison, this reflects a current preference, in my opinion, for Bitcoin's clearer value proposition. We just discussed it in uncertain economic conditions that we saw in April. Yeah, and most of you will very likely know what part of the root cause for these uncertain economic conditions was. We just observed implications of Trump tariffs also on crypto. The Trump administration's escalating tariff policies have created, well, an interesting economic environment for crypto assets. In early April, we saw the announcement of a 10% baseline tariff, with reciprocal rates set at half the level of tariffs imposed by respective countries on US goods. This was followed by a dramatic 90-day suspension of some tariffs, while simultaneously escalating Chinese import tariffs to 145%.
Yeah, and yeah. Michael, I mean, you have to say they claimed that they go at half the tariffs that are imposed on the US, but I mean, that was not what they were actually doing, because the math behind it was a bit messed up, right? I mean, they didn't say like France is asking us for 20% tariffs, now we are asking for 10. They used a different metric, which was a bit of a, I'm not sure where exactly that number came from, but it was not a 50% of reciprocal tariffs what they did.
Yeah, fair, good push. Thanks for correcting that. I think what's important, most important for us, is that these policies have two major implications for the crypto market. First, they're creating a stagflationary environment for crypto. We're seeing slower growth combined with rising inflation pressures. For example, the ISM manufacturing index dropped below 50, signaling contraction, while inflation metrics rose to 2.8% above expectations. Yet this economic backdrop has historically been favorable for hard assets like Bitcoin, to me explaining the robust performance of Bitcoin in April. And a second consequence, and perhaps even more significantly, the tariff policies risk exacerbating what economists call TRIFIN dilemma, So the US, as the issuer of the global reserve currency, the US naturally runs trade deficits as dollars flowed abroad. And by imposing tariffs that restrict imports, we're potentially reducing global demand for dollars, which could threaten the dollar's reserve status. And interestingly, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent acknowledged this at a March 7th crypto roundtable, stating, quote unquote, "We are going to keep the US the dominant reserve currency in the world, and we are going to use stablecoins to do that." So this suggests the administration views dollar-backed stablecoins as a potential mechanism to maintain US dollar dominance, even while at least Trump pursues protectionist trade policies.
I think that's a quite interesting point. I had this yesterday on a panel discussion, actually, where the moderator asked if stablecoins could be a threat to even increasing power of the US dollar as world leading currency. And I think it's the other way around, because if we see how the stablecoin market is divided, you have in the, let's say, regular market for currencies, maybe in terms of volumes, roughly a relation of euro to US dollar in terms of 1 to 3. So the volume might be like 3 times as high for US dollar as for euro. If you look at the stablecoin market, the ratio is 1 to 200, because the dominance there, of course, is incredibly. And if you look now, where is the US dollar being used? It's being used in poor and unstable countries, because there it actually provides a value, both in terms of storage of value, because the risk of holding a US dollar stablecoin is lower than holding the own currency, and it's harder to get to hard money in foreign currencies, especially US dollar. And it's also being used as a transaction layer, because you can, for example, exchange real US dollar in the currency exchanges against US dollar stablecoins. So in both terms or in two very relevant functions of money, it can already be used. And if a lot of people in these countries use it, the dominance of the US dollar is actually rising. On the other hand, I think the tariffs and the uncalculatable actions of the US government is for us as a stablecoin issuer in Europe even better, because it puts pressure on the need to have a European alternative. So for us as a euro stablecoin issuer, out of two reasons, the actions of the US government is positive. At first, because they push the crypto market, yeah, and at second, because they create so much uncertainty around USA as a stable political companion that it puts pressure on the European market to have sovereign alternatives.
And Simon, the pressure you're referring to already to some extent materializes, as was published surprisingly open this week in a, let's call it, debate between the European Commission and the ECB, but more on that later. Alex has an update.
Why later? I mean, we can talk about it now. I actually also wanted to raise that. So I fully agree with you, Simon, and I think we don't have a good, let's say, response to that in Europe at the moment. It's like Trump is pushing stablecoins a lot, very openly, and also Scott Bessent talking about, let's say, fostering the international role of the US dollars. And in Europe, particularly from the ECB, the answer is always yes, but we have our digital euro, our CBDC, which might go live in 2 years, but also in 4 years or 5 years. And yes, indeed, Politico has now summarized a debate between the ECB and the European Commission, a very interesting one and a surprisingly openly fought one. The ECB has, very strong concerns for crypto and stablecoins, in particular foreign stablecoins, specifically the dollar-backed ones. And they have warned that the MiCA rules might not be sufficient to protect the EU from US dollar inflows, let's say. So they are pushing for an update of MiCA. And then the Commission has pushed back. They've clearly rejected the ECB warnings, arguing that the ECB is misinterpreting MiCA. And they're insisting that it's basically good enough already to protect the EU from any, let's say, huge inflows of US dollar stablecoins. It's of course interesting to have that discussion against the background that the ECB is currently, of course, pushing a lot its digital euro. So, I mean, critics would say that they are, let's say, having the discussion in particular because they want to hype their own digital euro project. Yeah, I would say maybe quickly, and then I'm also interested in your views, of course. I would say it's of course totally fine to say I want to position the digital euro and the retail CBDC as one potential solution for, let's say, European sovereignty in payments and the international role of the euro. But what I do not understand is why the ECB at the same time is pushing so hard against stablecoins. And of course, they are mainly focusing on foreign stablecoins. But of course, this also has a very negative effect on European stablecoin projects such as AllUnity. And I mean, we have a proper regulation in Europe now. Stablecoins are e-money tokens, which the e-money directive is a regulation that exists for, I think, around 20 years. And I think it would be better for Europe to say, our answer is our own innovative solution around the future of payments, versus saying we are trying to defend ourselves by banning others.
I just wanted to add, I always like when large political institutions publicly insult each other in very fancy words to ultimately say, you're dumb. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I can really see both perspectives. The ECB is legitimately worried about what is referred to as financial dollarization through stablecoins, where dollar-based digital assets start displacing the euro for certain transactions, at least. We've seen this happen in smaller economies where dollar stablecoins have become alternatives to local currencies. Yeah, and the digital euro project is the elephant in the room here. The ECB has been positioning its CBDC as a defense against private stablecoins. So it's cool we have Simon here, but restricting private innovation might not be the best way to maintain monetary sovereignty. So this debate, and I hope it will be less public, at least as the only arguments are saying in fancy words, you're dumb. So I hope this debate will shape the future of the euro in an increasingly digital economy, in a nuanced approach with both institutions working together.
Yeah, I think also, Alex, you mentioned the approach to, let's say, try to keep private initiatives down in order to build large initiatives at first within already federal states that are divided in between each other with different banks, with different interests, and then even beyond, across Europe, even more federalization, even more discussions. It was exactly also around the stablecoin, because then somebody said at an event, yeah, why don't we join forces together? Is it bad that we have different initiatives in France, in Germany, in Iceland, in Finland? We should all bring it together to have this monster superpower stablecoin initiative. And I mean, you mentioned e-money being there for 20 years, and I just said, ah, yeah, we had this with payments. It was a very good initiative. It was called EPI, yeah? The EP payment worked really, really well. So it reminds me one-to-one at the development of PayPal with e-money initiatives and the pushback from the German credit industry to now fight the large PayPal, not with a private answer, with a private solution, but with consortias. Yeah, because consortias solve all the problems in the world. As we know from large institutions we are partially working in, the more people you get in, the better you solve the problem. And this has been the case in Germany as well, because we had PayDirect as the big opponent of PayPal that nobody really used ever. And then it merged with Girocard, and then it also destroyed Girocard. And now everything's together with the EPI. And still nobody's using it. And so I think the only answer to a strong private initiative, and we have strong private initiatives out of the US that are even completely unregulated. So we have the edge already because we have a regulated solution. But the answer is not a public or a consortia approach. It's again a private solution as a contrary answer.
Yeah, well, on paper, of course, consortia always look great. And of course, if everyone agreed now in Europe to back one project, that might even work. But I agree with you. I mean, EPI is now called Vero. I mean, they still exist. And I think they're coming back somehow. They have started in several countries now. Also, significant amount of clients. But it has taken a lot of years. And I mean, 50% of the original supporters have backed out. So yeah, I mean, I'm not even against a public-private partnership, as Piero Cipollone from the ECB is always asking for. Of course, he's referring when he says that to the digital euro, but why not having a public-private partnership when it comes to stablecoins? I mean, for instance, what the ECB could do is open its balance sheet to stablecoin issuers or EMT issuers in Europe and just say, look, we are supporting you by giving you access to our balance sheet. You are allowed to deposit your money on accounts directly at the central bank, giving you 100% security, fostering financial stability in Europe. That's how you as a central bank can support private initiatives in Europe. In parallel, you can still work on your digital euro, and then the market can decide what's the best solution to use in the end. All right. I mean, that I think was a nice introduction to our stablecoin part. As announced, we wanted to talk about Circle and its IPO. And what makes this so interesting is that Circle, as any company, has to file a so-called Form S1 registration statement when they want to do an IPO. And this form includes a lot of interesting information about Circle that have never been made public. First and foremost, financials. And yeah, we thought it's a nice moment to maybe take a look at how this company is working, how it's running, and maybe we can learn a bit for the stablecoin market overall. So let me maybe summarize the most important figures, and then happy to kind of get your views, Michael and Simon. So the S1 filing, it shows financials for the last 3 years, from 2022 to 2024. As of end of March this year, Circle had close to 60 billion USDC in circulation. That was a 24% market share. And Circle has, in particular, compared to Tether, actually a relatively diversified business model, because Tether is, of course, the USDT. They are now also starting to invest in other stuff, but it's mainly USDT. Circle has, of course, its Euro stablecoin. They have Circle Mint. They have developer services. They have acquired a Hashnode, which is a tokenized money market fund. They have transaction services. They have something that they call integration services. So when they integrate themselves into other blockchains. So actually a lot of, let's say, sources of revenue. But when you look at the numbers, 99% of their revenue still come from USDC, so from their US dollar stablecoin. Their revenues in 2024 have been 1.7 billion, so also significantly lower than for Tether. And what has been particularly significantly lower than for Tether is the net income, which I believe for Tether has been in the billions, maybe even double digit. I think around 10 billion even. I don't want to quote that wrongly, but I think more than 10 billion in 2024. For Circle, the net income has been 156 million. So significantly lower. And Circle tries to go public now at a valuation of around 5 billion. That's at least the number you always read in the press, which would be a 32x multiple, earnings multiple, which is not bad. I mean, I would say nothing is impossible on the stablecoin market when you look at some other deals that have been done in the past. But I found that was the first thing I found very interesting. I mean, revenues 1.7 billion is, of course, great. Net income 156 million. Well, that's, of course, not comparable to Tether in particular. So why is that the case? So let's maybe as a last point take a look at the cost. And when we take a look at the cost, by far the biggest cost item is distribution and transaction costs, which is the payments made to distribution partners of Circle or other, let's say, partners to incentivize distribution. And this was at around 1 billion in 2024. And it has also increased quite significantly over the last years, from 300 million in 2022 to now a bit more than 1 billion, which is more than 60% of the revenues, and which is, of course, mainly their deal with Coinbase. They have a deal with Coinbase and a lot. And I have seen the number more than 900 million, which is more than half of their revenues basically goes to Coinbase. And then you were always able to read in the press, yes, I mean, Coinbase is earning more with Circle's stablecoin than Circle does, which is, of course, a funny timeline. So, I mean, Simon, maybe to you, since you're also working a lot on a on a stablecoin business model. I mean, it looks, of course, way less attractive than Tether. But then always when I think about Tether, I think Tether is a bit of a unicorn. I'm not sure if anyone will ever be able to recreate something like Tether. So it feels to me a bit like that the business model here we see with Circle is actually a more realistic representation of how stablecoin issuers operate and how they make money than when you look at the Tether P&L, let's say.
Yeah, maybe two or three thoughts for the beginning. I think what is important to notice, I mean, comparing it to Tether is simply not the right reference point. Yeah, Tether is to some extent a unicorn, or at least a very special animal, I would say. And of course, earning that revenue with that few people is something that comes once in a lifetime. Yeah? So, and second, as you mentioned, the complete business model is different from each other. So, of course, everybody thinks like there are two large stablecoins. The larger one is the Tether. The smaller one is Circle. Actually, of course, they have complete different strategies and complete different approaches. So Tether is clearly fleeing any kind of regulation because their core business is so profitable that even spending one single thought on everything else is complete bullshit. Because as long as you can make such big revenues with so few people, everything else is a distraction and doesn't make sense for them. It will only worsen their business. So if you are in your mind, imagine to be the CEO of Tether, I mean, I would never spend a thought on doing something else as long as this works. Yeah. And with the US market still not being regulated with regards to stablecoins, there is no need or push to do anything else. Circle is the challenger. They have to do something. So if I would be in my mind the CEO of Circle, I wouldn't say like, let's do nothing else. Because you have the big competitor and you have to find an edge to beat them. So for that reason, they are in completely different positions. And due to the different positions, they also have different strategies. And Circle, that's the second most important point, is going towards regulation. So while Tether is fleeing regulation, Circle is trying to go into regulation. And sometimes also life is easier than we think for most of the time. And the closeness to Coinbase is a good example because Coinbase did exactly that, right? Coinbase is a very good example of a large crypto firm trying to go into, let's say, more realistic or also regulated business. They also did the IPO. So for me, it's kind of natural that they are in this closeness also to Coinbase, and the approach how Coinbase did it are going in a similar direction. And it's also not really unexpected news because some years ago, Circle already thought about going via an IPO. Yeah. And they did this even with a similar valuation, which is the only thing that for me is a bit difficult, at least, or alarming, even if you would be more dramatic, that you have this company where you would think the whole stablecoin market has rapidly developed and you're the second biggest provider in this massively growing market, but you have a similar valuation that you planned for with a SPAC IPO approach in 21. Now, with a full filing by yourself in 2025, where the market has skyrocketed, and your message is, yeah, it's pretty much the same value as back then. Of course, the formal, you mentioned the numbers, Alex, the formal process shows a very, very good development. But if I compare it to the failed spec listing, then I would say, what was the development in the last couple of years? But to be fair, I mean, back then, it was much harder to actually value such a company. So now with the numbers, with the specific approach, the volume development, we have more information. Yeah, so it's a more informed investor's decision. And of course, there are, which we, I think, are going to touch in a second, also developments that are pretty interesting with regards to content. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I appreciate Circle as a company a lot. I mean, they do a lot of innovative things, but just when I looked at the financials, I became a bit concerned, in particular when I saw how unbelievably expensive it seems to be to distribute the stablecoin. And in particular, what concerns me most is that it's a trend that it seems that like a Circle is facing scaling issues, because what we see is that the distribution costs become a higher and higher part of the revenue. So I have to spend more and more money to keep increasing my distribution. So when you look at in 2022, distribution costs were around 300 million. I've already mentioned that number, which was 40% of the revenues. In 2023, it was already 50% of the revenues. And now in 2024, it was 60% of the revenues. So what you see is that Circle has to spend a higher and higher amount of their revenues in order to keep growing. And the question is, of course, but is this a temporary thing? Because we have now a plethora of stablecoins at the moment. I mean, it's stablecoins everywhere. So of course, as distribution channel, meaning mainly as crypto exchange today, I could just ask for a lot of money to list, and then also and as a market maker, I can ask for a lot of money to provide liquidity. Maybe that's kind of leveling out going forward, but at least at the moment, it's extremely expensive. On the other hand, of course, Circle has profited a lot from these distribution agreements, in particular with Coinbase, and without Coinbase, they for sure wouldn't be where they are today.
Yeah, but Alex, I agree with distribution costs up 40% year over year, while revenue only grew 16%. The business model is deteriorating right at the moment when they're trying to go public. And what's particularly ironic is that Coinbase is making more money from USDC than Circle itself. The distribution agreement between the two may have helped USDC grow. So as you alluded to, Alex, it was an effective technique in growing, but at what cost? So Circle is essentially subsidizing their distribution partners at the expense of their own profitability, and that right at the moment when they're trying to go public.
I think, to be fair, this is also market development that we see. And it's also not new development. We have seen similar stuff also, for example, with distribution of new types of securities and stuff like that, incentive mechanisms there. This is clearly, I wouldn't put it all on Circle. And I agree with Alex that it's a company that has to be acclaimed for really pushing that stuff more towards regulation, building innovative business models and stuff like that. So I could agree with you that the numbers are not developing healthily, but I wouldn't say it's Circle's fault, so to say. Yeah, to put it very bluntly, I think it's a misfunctioning market. Yeah, and again, a market that is still not regulated now in the EU becoming regulated. And so I think there will be also a development to decrease these incentives simply because they will not lead to a functioning market, because they push stablecoin issuers into partially not functioning business models, even though they make a lot of money. So that's clearly a market misfunction out of my perspective.
Yeah. And there are, of course, limits to how much distribution channels can ask from stablecoin issuers until they will just stop paying. One last question to you guys on that IPO topic. I mean, my plan was here to speculate a little bit with you if there was a possibility that maybe someone just acquires a Circle at a discount pre-IPO. And I mean, yesterday evening, I read that actually the first offer arrived, which was from Ripple. And actually, it was part, I mean, Michael, you are my witness. I have it here in our document that we use as a preparation for this episode. I wrote, would anyone acquire Circle at a discount pre-IPO? Question mark. And then I said, Visa, MasterCard, Stripe, Ripple, and Coinbase. These would have been my top five. And Ripple actually made an offer. I wonder whether also Coinbase, I mean, it would be, we talked about it now, why would not just Coinbase acquire Circle?
But I think that's I mean, they make more money out of it. So yeah,
true.
If they buy it, they make it their problem.
Yeah, true, fair.
Yeah, I'd watch Visa or MasterCard closely. They have the distribution networks that could drastically reduce those costs, turning Circle scaling problem then into an opportunity. Ripple might also make an interesting acquirer now that their regulatory battles are largely behind them and they can focus on growing inorganically.
I would agree with Visa and MasterCard, by the way. Because to be fair, out of my perspective, it would be a bit of a costly but a promising way how to replace your legacy systems.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit like a bank buying a new bank and saying we are going to shift the systems on the new bank, because ultimately also the tech behind the payment networks is old. Yeah, and this stuff has proven to work, and now they're building even more with a payment network. So I, as a Visa or MasterCard, I could say, let's buy this stuff and just use it as the new tech backbone and be safe for the next 20 or 30 years in terms of tech adoption.
Yeah. And Visa and MasterCard are doing a lot around stablecoins. It seemed to be that Visa was a bit ahead, but now over the last week or so, there were like four or five, almost every day I've seen another MasterCard announcement that they're integrating stablecoin here and there. So yeah, I mean, Ripple has offered $5 billion according to Bloomberg. Also according to Bloomberg, Circle has declined that offer, saying it's too low. So let's see where this is going. All right, I would suggest that we move on to a couple of other stablecoin news. I would be relatively quick because the time is flying on the Circle Payments Network. Just a quick summary, because that's one of those things where stablecoin where Circle tries to diversify its business model a bit, except for only offering a US dollar stablecoin. They have now also announced that they want to launch a payment network that's called the Circle Payment Network. The goal is really, I mean, today cross-border payments are rather slow and expensive, yeah, in particular for emerging markets. So the goal is to offer an instant settlement and 24/7 connectivity among global financial institutions, including, of course, strong compliance, licensing, risk management standards. They have first partners already, including Banco Santander, Deutsche Bank, Societe Generale, Standard Chartered. Yeah, and the use cases include, for instance, supplier payments, remittances, payroll, capital market settlements, treasury operations. And it's expected to launch already in May 2025. So a bit of a Swift competitor almost always. Of course, the difference between, and that's the beauty of blockchain as well, the difference between Swift and Circle Payments Network will be Swift is a pure messaging network, right? You just say, look, I want to make that payment and the settlement happens afterwards. While when you do it on-chain, of course, you have that messaging about the payment and the payment itself, it's actually one thing. And that's the big difference. And yeah, I think we need something like that. Not sure whether it's this solution that's going to win in the end, but it's definitely the right direction. And then another interesting thing, because that's, of course, the big problem of stablecoins globally, is that they are usually not allowed to pay interest. And apparently PayPal has found a way to pay interest. They plan to offer 3.7% reward on their PYUSD stablecoin, like annual rewards for holding PYUSD in Venmo wallets. It was also reported by Bloomberg, and this is also expected to be rolled out in summer this year. And I guess, Simon, I mean, that's the big nut to crack, I believe, right? Stablecoin interest payments.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, especially in Europe, if you look at the MiCA, it's pretty clear that you don't have any chance to buy back incentives for holders in any kind, not even interest. So, of course, yes, this works for the PYUSD, but not for European regulated stablecoin. So this will be a big task, so to say. And of course, what the regulator tries to avoid is that stablecoins overtake banking, to make it very simple.
Mm-hmm.
Because assets will shift, and because you have the tech edge plus the interest. So this is really an incentive to move away your holdings from your bank account. Yeah? And thereby, stablecoin issuers become banks. Yeah? If they offer it like that. I mean, credit still missing, of course, yes. So for that reason, there are different rules in the MiCA that make it harder for stablecoins in Europe to move in that direction. Also, for example, how the assets are being invested. Yeah, that's also something where currently unregulated or US dollar stable coins have much more flexibility, which also leads to a transformation of time and risk, which is core banking functionalities. Because if they take the money, which should be available like instant from the clients, and put it into, let's say, even T-bills that are running for years, You have a transformation of time. And so for that reason, I think the move from PayPal is totally natural and of course possible in the US, but not in Europe right now.
The question is, of course, I mean, when I look at the drafts of these bills, the stablecoin bills that are currently discussed in the US, meaning the Stable Act and the Genius Act, they would also prohibit stablecoin issuers from paying interest to holders. And this now becomes already an interesting discussion because it says stablecoin issuers are not allowed to pay interest. When we look at PYUSD, actually Paxos is the issuer here, right? And not PayPal. So PayPal would be the distributor. In Europe, it's pretty clear also the distributors are not allowed to pay interest. I'm not 100% sure how it will be in the US. But I think as soon as we have a stablecoin regulation in the US, it will also be trickier to pay interest there, except, of course, if you just become a security. That's always possible, and then you're allowed to pay interest. But then, of course, you lose a lot of the utility of a stablecoin because you would have to do KYC with every holder and so on and so forth. Luckily, at least for the US now, there has been more clarity because until recently, it wasn't even clear whether stablecoins are securities in the first place. And Michael, I believe there is now some clarity around that question.
Yes, indeed. The SEC has now formally declared that covered US dollar stablecoins, specifically those that maintain stable value relative to the dollar and are backed by reserves like USDT and USDC. So those are not securities. Furthermore, persons involved in minting and redeeming these stablecoins don't need to register these transactions with the commission. And this announcement comes as Congress makes progress on its Stable Act, which would create a comprehensive regulatory framework for dollar-denominated stablecoins with reserve and capital requirements. Yeah, Bank of America CEO previously stated they would enter the stablecoin business if it becomes legally clear. So if this precise point becomes legally clear. My take is that this might be a consequential development, or if not the most consequential development of all. The SEC has completely reversed the previous administration's position under Gensler. The SEC consistently implied stablecoins could be securities, creating uncertainty. And now they're not only clearing the status of existing stablecoins, but creating a path for bank-issued stablecoins. I think this announcement lines up perfectly with congressional progress on the Stable Act. Bank of America CEO already said that they'd enter the stablecoin business, as I said before, if it becomes legally clear, and now it has. This could potentially grow the stablecoin market from hundreds of billions to trillions of dollars. And for institutional adoption, this removes one of the biggest roadblocks. Financial institutions can now confidently use stablecoins for settlement, trading, and treasury operations without fear of securities violations. Combined with the bank charter applications we're seeing from crypto firms in the US, we are looking at the foundation for a now more integrated crypto fiat financial system with clear rules of the road.
Good. So there was a long discussion around stablecoins. Now I would suggest that we move on. I think we have a couple of additional news, Michael, from the, let's say, CeFi world. Let's maybe try to summarize those and wrap it up in 10 minutes or so.
Yeah, challenge accepted. Let's go. A landmark deal has emerged with Tether, Bitfinex, SoftBank, and Cantor Fitzgerald launching 21, a Bitcoin-focused company listing on Nasdaq. Strike founder Jack Mellers has been named CEO, bringing his Bitcoin-native vision to this deal. The consortium has contributed around 36,000 Bitcoin, plus raised additional approximately 500 million in additional capital. This new firm, 21, will launch with 42,000 Bitcoin, becoming the third largest Bitcoin treasury globally. Their innovation lies in measuring performance entirely, I repeat, entirely in Bitcoin terms rather than dollars, with Cantor Equity Partners shares to, jumping 24% on the news. Yeah, and all of you now might think about MicroStrategy. To me, this goes far beyond MicroStrategy's approach to Bitcoin treasury management. 21 is reinventing corporate accounting, if you will, with Bitcoin native metrics such as Bitcoin per share and Bitcoin return rate. And with that, they're prioritizing Bitcoin accumulation over dollar profits, essentially denominating their business success in non-government currency. I think that's really cool.
I mean, it's of course interesting. I'm not sure if I would use the word cool because I'm not deep enough in there, and it's probably there is like more going on than what I understand. But in my simple world, you either have a use case that's called treasury, which is short-term liquidity management, which you would never do with Bitcoin because it's way too volatile to do that. And then there is a use case that I would say, I want to accumulate as many Bitcoin as possible, but then you become something like a Bitcoin fund or whatever. And somehow with MicroStrategy and also them, it's somewhere in between. I don't really know. So it's rather an interesting narrative that they are using here. I haven't understood, but that's maybe what I'm saying. That's why I said the disclaimer. I'm not deep enough in there, probably. I haven't really understood why they are not either a clear Bitcoin fund versus a normal company that does treasury management for sure without Bitcoin.
Yeah, then accepting your 10 minutes challenge, let's move on to Revolut. Revolut has posted remarkable annual results with 1.4 billion pre-tax profit, up about 150% year over year. But what's truly striking is their wealth division, including crypto, growing about 300% to 650 million approximately. Their customer base expanded about 40% with transaction volumes approaching the 650 million. And they've secured a UK banking license after a three-year process and launched Revolut X, their standalone crypto exchange platform. Yeah, to me, Revolut exemplifies the convergence of traditional banking and cryptocurrency, because this is crypto banking in its purest form, not offering crypto as a side feature, but really integrating it deeply into the financial ecosystem. And their nearly 300% growth in their wealth division proves that institutional grade crypto access drives engagement and profitability. Yeah, so again, it's cool to see Revolut growing and making profit with its crypto division. And then to complete the most relevant CeFi news, at least from our perspective, let's move on to Ripple. Ripple is acquiring Prime Brokerage Hidden Road for about 1.3 billion, a firm with over 300 institutional clients. This makes Ripple the first crypto company to own a global multi-asset prime broker. The deal enhances Ripple USD stablecoin utility as a collateral across prime products, with Hidden Road migrating its post-trade activity to the XRPL blockchain. Yeah, and adding to the positive sentiment here, Standard Chartered forecasts XRP, now the token, could reach about $13 by the end of 2028. And
I have no comment.
100 maybe, more realistic.
I mean, I have one comment about Ripple. I mean, I've never understood this company, and they have like this nice narrative that they will become the rails for banks and, let's say, international payments and clearing and settlement across banks, which is of course a huge market and a great use case. I think it didn't really turn out that it would be used as a solution by banks. Fair enough. I think that was an interesting thing to follow. What I do not understand is they have their own blockchain, they have their own token. Clearly, the use case they intended did not kick off, but still they like in the top five coins for many, many years. And I have never understood why. And whenever you talk to someone who is like not really deep into crypto, but still investing a little bit, almost all of them have XRP in their portfolio. So they have a very, very strong, let's say, brand name. And interesting enough, since they are, have a lot of money, they are now slowly becoming a very interesting company, because they are kind of acquiring very solid businesses like Hidden Road. Now we have talked about Circle. So it might actually be that they are now creating that business for which they are valued now for many, many years. So I'm actually becoming more and more positive about Ripple.
I see that you're overall becoming more positive about a lot of coins, Alex, which is a good thing. But yeah, maybe they're just a hidden PE fund where they got a lot of money from people that didn't know what crypto is and bought also some Ripple. And now you can buy Ripple to participate in the PE acquisitions that they're doing. Yeah, which is a good thing. Yeah,
this makes us actually come to our last section of today, which is US policy and regulation, in case you guys don't have anything to add for our DeFi news, CeFi news. Okay, yeah, let's, with that, we already talked about some European policy and regulation. Yeah, let's now move to you, to the US. And April 2025 has been a super interesting month for crypto regulation in the US, with Paul Atkins now officially chairing the SEC. We're seeing, yeah, a big change, if not a realignment of the regulatory landscape in the US. The SEC has formally declared that covered stablecoins like USDT and USDC are not securities anymore, while, as I explained before, banking regulators have begun dismantling barriers to crypto engagement with that. And meanwhile, Trump's family ventures into crypto are raising real concerns about conflicts of interest. I mean, that's the first time in history we're having a US president launching, the president and his family launching crypto ventures. And yes, this to, rightfully raises concerns about conflicts of interest. And then the divergence between US and EU approaches to crypto regulations are creating tensions, at least within Europe, as we explained before, again, like the tensioned conversations between ECB and the European Commission. So overall, my take on US policy and regulation is that what we're witnessing isn't just a policy shift, it's a regulatory revolution happening in real time after 4 years of Gensler essentially declaring war on crypto. The pendulum has swung more dramatically in the other direction than I expected. But this transition is messy and filled with contradictions, partially even debated openly, publicly. And the most important development out of them all, in my view, is what's happening with stablecoins. We talked a lot about stablecoins in this episode already. They are emerging as the crucial bridge between traditional finance and digital assets. And while the Europeans are panicking about crypto dominance, US banks are suddenly racing to get involved as they apply for bank charters in the US. And this divergence between US and EU is going to reshape, or is potentially going to reshape, where capital flows and where innovation happens over the next decade. And also for this reason, a small spoiler or add here, in our next episode with John Helgi Egilson, we exactly analyze these differences between European and US policy and regulation. Yeah, and now it's up to us to decide what's most interesting to us all. Is it the official confirmation of SEC chair Paul Atkins? Is it that the Fed rescinds anti-crypto guidance? Is it that Democrats fear Trump's crypto entity or the Trump family's crypto ventures pose regulatory conflict? What do you think? What's the most relevant out of them all?
I think it's in general, and this plays to the whole, let's say, vibe we received from the US over the last months. These are all additional data points that just prove that situation has totally changed in the US. It has been more like announcements over the last months, and now all these things that have been announced are implemented. I mean, the Fed chair, it's not news, but now he's there, right? I mean, it's not a surprise. It was very positive that it has become more, the crypto regulation has become more friendly towards banks in the US. It will be very interesting whether the US actually signs the Basel capital requirements, which are very, let's say, dangerous or prohibitive for banks. So that's going to be interesting. But for me, everything you've just mentioned, Michael, are just additional data points, additional proof that the wind has turned in the US to a very, very crypto-friendly situation.
Agreed. And I would shift maybe a bit towards Germany again. Like, we're talking so much about the US, and now we have a German government incoming, and then they want to spend a lot of money for infrastructure. So, guys, I mean, US is building crypto infrastructure. Why is nobody talking about this? I think that's a discussion that we have to open up.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's the perfect way to end this episode. Dear German government, get ready. We are going to reach out, having conversations about exactly this topic, the future of the German and European payments landscape, the international role of the euro, and the role that stablecoins have to play in that regard.
All right. I think that nicely concludes our today's episode. I think next to the stablecoin discussion we had today, it's in particular the diverging approaches of US and European policy in regulating crypto markets. More on that next episode. With that, I thank you all for making it to the end. Stay committed or engaged with our community on Telegram. Join our website to learn everything about our podcast. And in particular, let's thank Simon for making it on a bank holiday to our podcast, for sharing his precious stablecoin insights. Thank you, Simon.
Thanks for the invite. Was fun. So all good.
Thanks for coming, Simon, in particular at 8 in the morning. Appreciate that. Enjoy your holiday, guys, and then see you soon.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.